Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. I am Rob Cope, and as always, I'm sitting with Dan Farrant. How's it going, Dan?
Doing well, Rob. Thanks. How about you?
Yeah, very good. We're recording a little earlier this week because I'm going away. I'm going to Russia next week.
Oh, why are you going to Russia?
I'm going on the Donald Trump reality tour.
What does that entail?
I'm not really sure. I guess it involves...
Are you working for him?
I am, because I'm a spy that no one would ever suspect.
Right, okay.
And anyone that's looking for me probably wouldn't listen to the Jazz Podcast. So the idea is that I go to Russia and I figure out just how many votes the Russians, I reckon like a good 95% of Donald's votes are probably forged. And I'll figure out why and how. A bit like that Simpsons when Sideshow Bob becomes the mayor and then Lisa figures out that he used people that are dead. He registered them to vote, and then like everyone who's ever lived in Springfield voted for Sideshow Bob, and that's how he won. I imagine I'll uncover something like that, and then Donald chase me through the sort of cold Russian or like the steppe, you know, the wilderness. And also watch that
what are you talking about, Rob?
I don't know. This is we're hitting an all-time low now, aren't we? I watched that Top Gear last night where they go to the Baikonur Cosmodrome. Oh, it's so good.
Nice.
I was like in tears about Top Gear.
What, it being over?
No, it just the start of a new season. And
so is it fake news today then? Is that because you're...
No, there's some really terrible news, which is that I thought about having a minute's silence for it, but I thought that wouldn't make for a very good podcast. But the Forge is closing.
Oh, no.
As we record, it's closing today, 31st of March.
Oh, that's a shame.
I know. So this will be next week's show. It'll have been gone for a week by now.
How come? What happened?
I don't know why.
They didn't hire you to play.
Well, some of my fondest memories in London are playing at the Forge, because there was always a venue that would give youth an opportunity to play, you know? A bit like Man United during the Ferguson era. Good balance of established art acts and then letting people start nights and try stuff out.
Yeah. Did you see any of there's some paintings of me up on the wall there.
Yeah, I've seen that, and obviously they'll be auctioned off for a substantial price, I would think.
I am going to see if I can pick those up.
That would be good. And then you should try and get it hung at another venue or something.
Oh, in my own home. Ooh. Oh, yeah, I could try and make a tour of the venues.
Yeah, that would be great. Like, you could start that as a thing. The press release here just says, after 8 years, the Forge is to close its doors with the final event taking place on the 31st of March. Here we go. Co-founder Adam Card said the directors of the Forge have decided to close the venue. Running a music venue in these times is exceptionally tough, and we have reached a point where it's time to close the doors and move on to new challenges. We're immensely proud of what we have achieved over 8 wonderful years, and our heartfelt thanks go to anyone and everyone who has contributed and enjoyed this unique venue.
I remember when it opened.
I do as well. I was still at the RNCM, and Andy Scott was telling me about this brand new venue down in Camden. It didn't mean anything to me at the time.
Yeah, they had good pasta there.
Oh, yeah, if you played in the band, you'd get like tomato pasta
yeah,
for dinner.
I always enjoyed that.
Did you play there very much?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. Mm.
I did two real corkers. In fact, no, several. I once played J.J. Wheeler, did his Comeback Stronger gig there for the first time. Remember day? Because about 5:30 p.m., for a gig that started at 7, Ruben got a call to would he go in depth in Prince's band for a gig in town.
Oh, right.
And obviously he like packed up his trumpet and left in a police car. So Tom Dennis came in depth at the last minute. Nice. But that was cool. That was Ruben's first Prince gig. That was the start of a...
Is that why he didn't make the podcast last week doing our news? He got a call about doing someone's band.
Yeah, it must have been.
Yeah.
But, oh, no. His dog Brosnan. He had to take Brosnan to the vets. Yeah, I know. And now, this Friday, it's only 8:23 a.m. So there's absolutely no chance of him getting up.
Yeah.
So I thought, we'll get there. We'll make it happen. Right, what else is in the news? I found something else. Oh, Empirical pop-up lounge goes nationwide. So at the end of April, Empirical, who are Tom Farmer, Nathaniel Facey, Lewis Wright, and Shane Forbes, they're going to go on a field trip to Birmingham. They'll be taking over an empty shop in the Great Western Arcade and then, like, playing jazz.
Great.
Well, commuters, like, go to work and come
Ignore
back.
Them.
Yeah, I guess. They're doing gigs at, like, 8 a.m. while people
trek
across the city. Hopefully,
I once got asked to do magic at King's Cross.
Yeah.
To people coming off the trains at like 8 in the morning.
Wow. But nobody wants to stop.
I told them that was a terrible idea.
Did you?
I said no.
Oh, phew.
I said it won't work.
No, it I can't believe that it
would. But I imagine music would be a lot better because you don't have to stop and engage someone.
So this week is the first of our jazz podcast international series because it's Will Vinson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Will was born in London and raised in London, but has lived in New York for, I guess, his whole career. So it's a fine balance because obviously our podcast is a UK jazz-based one, but this is the first of a medium to small-scale international series where we lynch people that have moved abroad.
Expatriated.
Exactly, that's the one. So, yeah, Will is he's a trendsetter.
Great. I wasn't around for this interview, so I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Will's one of Britain's finest improvising saxophone players and one of our very finest exports as well, as he now lives in the States. He's recorded a huge amount of solo work and loads as a sideman, played all over the world and played with so many important other jazz musicians. So we're very lucky to have had him. And here is one of his tracks. This is Squeeze from the album Stockholm Syndrome.
Let's put it on.
Should we? Yeah, let's do it. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in London, in Muswell Hill. Do you know where that is?
I do. I used to live in Tottenham.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So not far away, just up the hill. But actually, you know, when I got your text like an hour ago, I was at the supermarket and it mentioned that you were that the plan was to interview people on the scene.
Oh yeah.
And I, my first thought was, I'm not actually on the scene. and then I was like, well, how long has it been since I was on the scene? Then I realized I've never been on the London scene, because I grew up there, but
yeah,
you know, I wasn't on the scene. And then I left and then I was like, how long has it been since I left? And then I realized it's been 21 years.
Wow.
So thanks for reminding me about that.
Oh, that's brilliant. I apologize for that. It's quite interesting because I was trying to Google your history and when you'd moved and where you'd lived. And I couldn't really find anything about
like,
when you left London, at least like the early Will Vinson years on your biography. So it was just like Will left London in like 1999
I moved to New York in 99, but I left London before that because I went to university in Bristol. So,
okay, cool.
96, I guess. So yeah, 21 years ago.
Oh wow!
But of course, I mean, I'm there pretty often. I'll be there next week. Actually, I'll be in London.
Yeah.
For a few days.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I actually feel a bit more connected to it these days than I did for the first, say, 10 years that I lived in New York, because, I mean, when you know, anyone that moves to New York as a musician gets immediately swept up and sort of feel like there isn't any other place on earth.
Yeah, I can well believe it.
That's worth your, you know, well, actually it's not even that. It's just that it's just so exhausting being here. And also the other thing about being a musician in New York, at least in my case and a lot of other people's cases, there are exceptions, of course, is that, I mean, I came here as a student. I didn't have any money and I didn't have any gigs, so I wasn't leaving. You know, there's nothing taking me out of town to work or anything like that. And so I was just here the whole time, and I probably went home. Well, I went home a few times during that period, but these days I'm back. I still find myself describing it as home, but it isn't. It isn't really. But I go back to London.
Yeah.
I don't know, between 2 and 4 times a year.
Yeah, that's quite a lot. That's quite a
decent
amount to be.
I mean, I'm very fortunate because I don't have to actually, make those trip. I'm sorry, my cat's nose is in my ear and is purring very loudly. Anyway, I don't have to plan those trips myself. I go to Europe a lot, and so it's very easy for me to tack on a few days at the front or back end of those. That's what I'll be doing next week, and I'll be doing that again later on in the year. So it's great. It's really easy.
Sorry, go on.
No, I'm done.
I was just curious about how often you come here to play, or if you're just coming to like see family.
Yeah, I mean, I used to, touring with my band, I would always try to make a stop in London.
Yeah.
Usually at the Pizza Express. And I haven't done that the last couple of times I've been touring, because the dates haven't worked, but it looks like I will be there in September for a couple of nights. It's become quite difficult in the very recent past because of the plummeting value of the pound. It was already hard to make touring making stops in the UK cost effective, and now it's basically you just sort of have to give up and suck it up and lose money. Which I don't mind doing, because I really like to play in London if possible.
Yeah.
So I think I'll be there, and I believe I'll be there in September.
Oh, cool.
A version of my band.
Well, we're lucky that you feel that way about London, because I think culturally it's got a lot to lose right now.
I agree. I think it's on a precipice.
Yeah, I noticed a major orchestra has relocated to Brussels.
Yeah, I read that too.
It's a bit depressing.
Yeah, I do. I worry about my. I mean, I'm not really worried about myself, but I do worry about my colleagues.
Yeah,
because you know, music, I mean, what we're doing requires us to be as entrepreneurial as possible, you know, to play our music and to take it to the world. And we really do have to take it outside of our borders if we're going to,
yeah,
you know, make it work in a viable way, and also keep ourselves educated about the world and about audiences and about performing. Because, you know, the UK is one type of, well, it's not one. I mean, obviously there are many different types of places that you can perform in the UK, but there is an experience that you have there, and then there are experiences elsewhere that you don't have in the UK. And you know, something that I've always valued enormously about my citizenship is my, you know, totally red tape free ability to travel in Europe and work and, you know, settle if I want to. And that's something that my US colleagues don't have to the same extent. And now I'm not going to have it. And that's very, very distressing for me, but I'm even more worried about, you know, my friends who actually live in the UK.
Yeah. And the thought of getting a work permit to do like a gig in France is just sad beyond thought.
I know. I know. Especially if, you know, there are costs involved and it ends up, you know, I mean, tour budgets are on a knife edge to begin with. And then, you know, I mean, for a while, Canada had a really draconian policy with the United States. I mean, the States is obviously not very easy either if you're not a legal resident, but you know, if American musicians or non-Canadian musicians wanted to perform in Canada, you had to pay a fee of $250 per person per gig.
Yeah.
So you take a quartet up there, and you know, and the gig pays $2,000, and you spend $1,000 of it on travel, and then you have to spend the other $1,000 of it on the thing, and you know.
Yeah.
But thankfully they've ditched that. So it's now much easier.
Thank God. I mean, again, like, they're just going to damage their own hopes of a outside culture,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, in places with small populations like Canada definitely benefit from having people. Well, everyone benefits from importing culture. I mean, it's,
yeah. You
know, And Britain's no exception, and exporting it too.
Yeah.
So I'm not very. I don't have a lot of optimism about this. I mean, if this thing becomes what it's advertised to be, then I think it's going to be Well, I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm not optimistic.
No, it's not going to be what it is now. It's sad to kind of go backwards, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you said you would, Bath or Bristol, was it you said?
Bristol University.
What did you study there?
Well, I studied music. But of course, studying music at a university is it's a different thing in the UK than it is most other places, I think. I mean, when I tell people here or anywhere else in the world that I studied music, they say, oh, you know, did you major in saxophone or in jazz or whatever? But a university music degree, you could probably get through just about without playing an instrument. I mean, it was very academic. And there's a lot of head scratching about that when I explain to people what's actually involved. It's a funny idea, the sort of humanities, your music as a humanities subject or whatever, however you would
look.
But there was no design to that. It was, I didn't really, I mean, I knew I wanted to be a musician, but I didn't know what the best higher education solution to that was going to be. I mean, I thought about applying to, you know, the Royal Academy and the Guildhall and all those places, but I was so it didn't have a lot of belief in my ability to be accepted to any of those
right
colleges. because I didn't really have any formal training, and you don't want to know what my sight reading was like. And I was really, really paranoid about all those kinds of things. And I was pretty shy when I was a kid, and I hadn't really played with people very much. And I just thought, well, I'm not really cut out for those institutions. So, and then of course there's the other UK tradition, which I really like, of leaving home to go to university, which most other people don't do. And you know, if I was going to go to a music college, it was probably going to be in London.
Yeah.
And if I was going to be in London, I was going to have to stay home, and I didn't want to do that. So I don't think my parents wanted me to do that either. So
yeah,
I went to Bristol, and it was fine. I mean, I learned a lot of things, which I think have been instructive, but I didn't play very much. But fortunately, I played a saxophone, which is not a terribly difficult instrument. So that's not really the main challenge in what I do. What do you play, Rob? Sorry.
A saxophone as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I did. It's quite an interesting story to listen to yours, because a lot of people like me and the younger guests we've had have kind of done quite a typical, like, grew up, went to college. You like, you know, music college, and I did an undergrad, like, classical saxophone, and then I did that in Manchester. Like you say, my parents lived in Manchester, but I wanted to go to the Northern, because there's a guy there, Andy Scott and Rob Buckland. These sax players, they were just, I'd grown up knowing about them. I always wanted lessons from them. I still lived in halls, and then like rented flats and houses, even though my family were like 30 minutes away.
Well, it's a bit easier to do that in Manchester.
Yeah, it didn't cost so much. But like you say, there's a cultural thing about it. I couldn't bear the thought of staying at home and being at university at once. And that was not a mixture I wanted to entertain.
No.
so I did that, and then moved to London and did the postgrad academy with jazz, which is when we met. It was about 3 or 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
You came and were like,
I was hoping we were going to be on FaceTime, you know, video, so I'd actually be able to see you and recognize you.
I can text you a picture of me.
Okay, that'd be great.
Sounds so vain, doesn't it? Oh my God. I'm totally going to do that right now. I accidentally sent you a photo of Steve Berry, and I couldn't stop it. it went before
you just couldn't
I could.
Stop. Isn't that Edward Snowden? Oh no, okay, right.
It sent so fast, I couldn't get it back. Anyway,
well, that's great. It's nice to see that. It's lovely. Lovely picture of Steve. Cool.
Yeah. Sorry. So. So after Bath, I just want to know. Sorry, Bristol.
Fine.
Real quick, when did you start playing the saxophone?
I got one when I was 11, but I was already playing the piano. So at my school, there was no saxophone teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I took lessons with a sweet guy, but like a much older, classical clarinet player, and you know, he was cool. He was very encouraging, really nice. But of course, I wasn't really learning much about the saxophone, and I wasn't to the extent that I was learning about jazz. It was actually from my piano teacher, whose name is Leon Cohen. He's just an incredible teacher. And a really good jazz pianist, but he taught me. He lived in East Finchley. He lives in East Finchley.
Yeah.
He taught me, and he taught Ollie Rockberger. Do you know him?
No, I don't.
Ollie's a pianist who keyboard guy who he lived in New York for a while. He just moved back last year. He plays with Laura Mvula, and he plays jazz, but he's not really in that world so much. He's more doing kind of pop R&B stuff. He's a really good musician.
Yeah.
A really nice singer, songwriter too. Anyway, so I studied with Leon, and he taught me everything I was learning about jazz.
Right.
And harmony and how to play and forms and tunes and everything was coming from him. So, and then I just sort of applied that to the saxophone. I didn't have a saxophone teacher for real until a bit later, when I started taking lessons from Jim Tomlinson, who became the peripatetic teacher at my school when the other guy retired.
Right.
So Jim is, I don't know if you know him, but he's married to Stacey Kent, the singer.
Oh, okay.
And he's a really good, a great, very, very beautiful player, like in the sort of Stan Getz kind of
Very nice
realm. I mean, if you hear her records and there's saxophone on it, then that's who it is. I mean, he's a really, really nice player. And he was great. And then later on, I studied with Tim Garland a little bit. Actually, that was after I started going to university. So until Jim, I didn't really have a saxophone teacher, and I was teaching myself. So I wanted to be a pianist. I wanted to be a jazz pianist. But I don't know. Like most musicians, I guess I had a lot of anxieties and neuroses about my various shortcomings. And because I was pretty shy, like I never really got involved in any kind of camps. You know, I didn't go to any of the jazz summer schools or anything. I just thought I was going to suck too hard, and I also, so I just had no experience. I was just playing on my own, and you know, there were elements of my piano playing that were somewhat deficient, I suppose. But then I also, between high school and university, I started to develop a sort of tendonitis type thing, and it didn't affect my saxophone playing, only my piano playing. So that's kind of what made the decision for me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And that was that. Yeah.
So after Bristol,
I've regretted it ever since.
Well, we have to do less practice, I guess. Not have to, but like you say, saxophone, there's harder things you could play.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As a result, 20 years later, I still don't know how to practice.
That's a great side effect of playing the saxophone, learning how to practice.
Yeah.
Did you leave for New York after, straight after you graduated?
I did, yeah. And again, you know, this was another sort of haphazard decision. I never thought that I was going to be in New York.
Yeah.
It wasn't an ambition, just because it just didn't seem like a possibility. If I'd seen it as a possibility, I would have, Oh, there you are.
You just get that. I'm the one on the right, obviously.
Right, yeah. Okay, cool. I remember you. It didn't seem like it just wasn't something, you know, it was like growing up imagining living on the moon. It was, nobody does that because nobody lives on the moon. But then I was at university and I sort of vaguely pondering what I was going to do next. And I met an Italian bass player called Andrea Pedroro. Mm-hmm. And he was doing the film music masters at Bristol, which apparently is very prestigious.
That sounds great. And, that's a cool thing to do.
Yeah. And the guy who teaches it or taught it at the time was a guy called Martin Kisco, who does all the BBC wildlife scoring and a lot of, I mean, that was 20 years ago that he was doing that. So you probably find his name on a lot of other credits these days. He was really good. Anyway, so Andrea was a really nice guy, and I was like the only other person interested in playing jazz or that was playing jazz at the university. So we played together a little bit. I did a recording with him. And he told me about Manhattan School of Music, which is where he'd gone for his undergrad.
Yeah.
And this was in my last year at Bristol. And I just thought, I looked it up and next thing I knew I was applying to do a master's. And then I came to New York. And
did you do a video audition first or anything?
No, they weren't doing those in those days.
Oh, right.
You had to come here. So I So I paid, like, I don't know why I remember this, but I paid £194 for my transatlantic round trip.
That's incredible. Holy wow.
And I remember being really annoyed because, like, the week before it had been 175. So I came here and I did an audition for, and the panel was, it was two guys I didn't know and Mark Turner.
Nice.
And I was just like, I was so sort of sheltered, was I, in my little world of, like, listening to, idols and then going to see them at, play concerts in London. But I just sort of, I was still in that kind of starstruck sort of stage where I didn't even see those people as being, like, actual real people. You know, they're just sort of demigods.
Yeah. The idea that he's doing a job and paying rent.
Doing a job, like sitting behind a desk with a pen and paper, sitting in it, wearing a tracksuit. And then afterwards, he spoke to me, or I sort of ran into him in the stairwell, and I don't remember what he said, but he was really nice. And that just totally, made my day. It was amazing.
Yeah. Feeling.
And I hung out with, Andrea was there because he was now back in New York doing something else. What was he doing? I don't remember, but, he was one of those, like, eternal students.
Yeah, yeah, the ones.
Italian style. he was doing, like, another... He was doing a PhD at NYU, that's right. Anyway, so I was hanging out with him and his friends and just, in the sort of... I was only here for, like, 3 days, but I was in the kind of jet lag haze and going out to... I saw Barry Harris at the Village Vanguard and saw a bunch of other music and was just so swept away in the romance of New York.
Yeah.
And then I got in, but I didn't get a scholarship. They had this incredibly sort of rigorous financial disclosure form that your parents had to fill out. My parents, being, like, super conscientious, middle-class English educators.
Yeah.
Were really conscientious about it, and they actually put in the value of their house,
Yeah,
which was supposed to, right? Well, of course, they could have made it up because they could have said that they didn't have a house, but anyway, so that just kind of rendered me eligible for a scholarship. So that was a drag, but tuition. Sorry, I find myself this morning being slightly slow finding the words. I don't know if I had a stroke in the night, but I just got back from Australia a few days ago, and I'm really a bit still in a bit of a weird jet lag zone. But anyway, let's see. Yeah, so I didn't get a scholarship, and tuition in those days was a stratospheric $15,000 a year.
Yeah.
Now,
that's a lot. That's still a lot.
Well, it is, but of course,
but it's nothing. Yeah.
It's three times that. Now.
Yeah.
But amazingly enough, like, I went back to do my last term at Bristol, and I went to see my advisor about, to talk about it, and it turned out that there were all these scholarships that you can apply for. So I got one from an organization called the Countess of Munster Musical Trust.
I got one from them as well.
You did? Oh, good for you. Yeah.
Maybe they could sponsor this show.
Oh, cool. I got one from the Musicians Benevolent Fund.
Awesome.
And I got some other stuff and then I took out, I wasn't going to take out a student loan that year, but I took one out in the UK and then, just socked it away.
Yeah.
And I managed to get it together somehow.
That's amazing.
I stayed at the International House, which is like a big dorm for graduate students, postgraduate students. on the uptown Manhattan, and made it, lived on, you know, brown rice. Nah, actually, I never ate brown rice, but whatever.
Yeah.
Other. And made it work, and then managed to repeat the scholarship thing the following year, and I got a bit of a scholarship from school, so it was good. And I managed to graduate without really any debt. I think I had my my UK student loan, which was about £5,000. But meanwhile, I was at Manhattan School with people who had, you know, American students who had done their undergrads in American schools, perhaps the Manhattan School or whatever.
Yeah.
And were doing their postgrads and had student loan debt of like, you know, $120,000.
Yeah.
And these days, of course, it would be even more than that. And it's just, I mean, I feel so lucky. I'm so lucky. I mean, all the things that have kind of conspired to make the life that I have possible.
Yeah.
There's always struggles, and you know, there's always a bit of a question mark over everything, but at least I don't have $100,000 or $200,000 student debt, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just a ridiculous, especially for like a career in jazz.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, that's incredible. So and that's a thing that I have so much admiration for anybody who moves to New York now.
Yeah.
Because it's so much harder. I mean, it was hard when I moved, and it'll probably be harder in another 20 years.
Yeah.
If it's here. I have students coming and they're so good, and everyone's like 10 times better than we were when I was 20, and they're working really hard and they've got no money. And it's just amazing. It's amazing that continues. I mean, it always feels unsustainable.
Yes.
You know, on a personal level, but then also on a, you know, universal level.
Yeah.
And I remember being amazed, when I first discovered that there were even jazz schools. I mean, this is, you know, when I was like 14 or something, and I found out about the Royal Academy or whatever. And I was just like, oh my God, there are actually people who are taking this seriously and making, making this their life's direction, and the people are still doing that. It's just very, yeah. It's I fear for them, of course, and for myself, but I admire it too. I mean, it's great. It's and I imagine that's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
In fact, the idea that it used to be easier, I mean, I think it's dumb. And probably, you know, there have probably been times when it might have been easier, but there are also times when it was a lot harder. And
I guess some things are easier now. Like it's easy to like check someone out, go on YouTube. Like it's not hard to find resources and music to listen to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you read the Thelonious Monk biography by Robin Kelly. I don't know if you've read that.
No, I haven't.
It's just called His Life and Music or something. It's an amazing read. Exhaustively researched. The first few chapters he doesn't even feature in them. It's about his parents and grandparents. But you know, the absolute, like, you know, the conditions that African American musicians had to persevere through. People like him, you know, getting to towns and not being allowed to stay in hotels and having to go to, you know, the first stop you would have to make at a town was the church, and, you know, appeal to people to let them stay in your home while you perform in the town. I mean,
it's unbearable to think about.
Not even in the same universe of experience. So whatever happens, whatever happens to us, however it goes, however unlucky we feel at any moment, to be alive as a result of playing music is kind of incredible.
Yeah, totally.
privilege.
There's a cool film out at the moment, Hidden Figures. I don't know if you've seen about that. Three female mathematicians in the 1960s working for NASA in Langley, Virginia, which is still like a state of segregation, you know, it's not allowed to like use the same bathrooms as the white employees. Just unbelievable to imagine that there was ever a time where like people of different race were treated so differently and some so badly.
Not that long ago. And it hasn't left us yet. So
no,
that's true. I mean, anyway, that's another subject.
So when you finished at Manhattan School, at what point did you decide that you were going to stay in New York?
Oh, after about 5 minutes.
Just still waiting for your bag at the airport.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, actually, that's the one moment where you feel like you want to go home. Baggage retrieval at JFK is still it didn't take long. I think for a long time I had a slightly false sense of what New York actually was, though, because you're in your own little universe, your own little bubble at school, and it kind of feels like the whole thing, and then of course you leave and you realize it's much bigger and scarier. But it was a matter of, well, okay. So it was a 2-year degree. And at the beginning, my assumption was that I would do 1 year or hopefully 2 years and then come back to London with all my amazing newfound knowledge.
Yeah.
Ability. And, but you know, a couple of months in, I was hanging out with some, friends, and there was a Canadian guy who was applying for his artist visa, and then that became like the holy grail was the artist visa, the O-1 visa.
Oh, right, cool.
The thing that you can... Oh, actually, I also found out upon arrival that with a student visa, you, and I think this is still the case, you can, if you have a student visa, when it's done, when your degree is done, you're allowed to stay for another year and work within the field of your study.
Right.
So I had 2 years, and then I did that. And then, I got an artist visa. And then I got another artist visa, and then I got another artist visa.
Were they hard to get, those artist visas?
Well, the first one was very scary because you know, you have to bring a portfolio of evidence that you are an accomplished musician.
Yeah.
If you haven't performed very much, there's not a lot of evidence. Or even if you have, if there's no press.
Yeah.
But an amazing stroke of luck that I became part of I hadn't thought about this for a while, but I became part of a band that was formed at Manhattan School of, you know, students.
Yeah.
One guy from Australia, who was a pianist, a drummer from Vienna, and a bass player called Thomas Morgan, who you probably know. Or maybe you don't, but he plays.
I've gone very quiet because I don't, and I was trying to get away with it.
No, it's fine. he's an amazing bass player. He plays with Bill Frisell sometimes, plays with Steve Coleman. Oh, right. Anyway.
Sweet.
So he was, so we had this little band, and the drummer from Austria, Peter Gabbis, set up a tour in Austria, Germany. Maybe we went to Czech Republic, I don't know, but and he got a publicist for the tour too. And this was in the summer after my final year at Manhattan, before my year of, they call it optional practical training, which is when you get that extra year.
Yeah.
And so there was all this press from this tour that we did. They were like, we did like 30 gigs in about a month and a half. It was amazing. I mean, looking at it now, I'm pretty sure we didn't make a penny, and they were pretty lousy gigs, but they generated some press. And so I was able to make a portfolio. So you need that, and you need letters of recommendation and whatnot. So I, As I thought at the time, you need a lawyer. So I paid a lawyer. It turns out you actually don't need a lawyer for non-immigrant visas.
Oh, right.
So the next couple of times I managed to do it without. But that's a sort of the O-1 visa application is a rite of passage of every non native New Yorker musician who wants to stay. Everybody's done it.
So I
discovered that possibility during my first year, and then I just thought, well, maybe I never have to leave, or maybe I don't have to leave right away. Maybe I can stay for a bit. There was an assumption that I was going to go back to the UK for a while, but then, you know, when you leave your home country, it's always kind of your, like, the center of your orbit in a way, in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in a place like New York, it's no longer like there's America and then there's the UK, because everybody here is from somewhere else in the world, and suddenly your horizons just expand so much further.
Yeah.
And you're no longer really thinking about that sort of binary existence. I mean, even though I have only ever lived in the UK and in New York, these days I'm fortunate enough to spend a lot of time in other places in the world. And that's really important to me. Another great privilege that I have.
Yeah.
So eventually that sort of assumption began to recede.
Did you get a citizenship eventually?
Not yet. I have a green card now, and I've had it for 5 years, and it's 5 years that you need to have it before you can apply for citizenship.
Cool.
I haven't 100% decided to do that, but I think I'm going to.
Yeah. Is there a reason why? Well, first of all, is the green card a difficult thing to get then?
Yeah. It's not easy. I mean, if you want to get it the easiest way to do it is to be married.
Right.
An American. It's still a headache if you do that, but basically if you don't have a major criminal record,
and
you are married to an American, then you will get a green card.
Right, okay.
It's not like in the UK. I mean, I have friends who are married to British citizens and their visa applications are rejected.
That's so ridiculous.
I know, it's awful. It's awful.
Mm.
I have some people staying with me right now, actually, who fit that description.
That's horrendous.
It is awful. So they've moved here because Britain has rejected them.
Yeah, I've actually only had one experience with the embassy like that, and it didn't go well either.
Which embassy?
With the British embassy, trying to get friends in from Kenya.
Right.
You know, just to like show them the country, and they couldn't get a visa to come in just because that's how they felt.
Yeah. It's embarrassing.
It is.
Anyway. But I got mine through, applying as a, alien of extraordinary ability.
A very self-satisfying form. I love it. You have to
listen. So I did that, and it's the same process as the O-1, but it's just a bit more intense.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I'm glad I did it when I did instead of doing it earlier, because I might have been rejected earlier on. But
yeah,
you know. So anyway, so I have a green card, and that's great. And I'm now eligible to apply for citizenship. And
that's cool.
I probably will.
So if you did, would you have to brush up on your like American history and presidents and take like an exam?
You do have to take a little exam. Yeah. I'm not sure how much brushing up I would have to do, because I'm interested in history and anyway, you don't have to, your knowledge does not have to be terribly nuanced or advanced.
Yeah.
Probably have to learn a few dates and stuff like that. Yeah. And I would probably have to take the oath in a room that will probably have a picture of Donald Trump.
That's fantastic. A big and a massive portrait of Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, totally. I guess are people, as any, do you ever, do you steer clear of talking about Trump? Is that like the way to go with it, or are you kind of out there?
Okay, well, first of all, Hillary Clinton got 87% of the vote in Manhattan.
Oh, Jesus, that's a big number.
That's, I mean, it's like a Saddam Hussein style
victory. Yeah.
So there's no love for Trump in New York, and I think it's going to be the centers of resistance to his presidency, and you sort of discover when someone truly menacing like him comes along, you sort of discover actually some of the things that do make America uniquely kind of amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Obviously, it's uniquely amazing in that, well, not uniquely, but it is amazing in that it managed to elect him in the first place. But but it's also amazing in that it does actually have like a working, sometimes very imperfectly or belatedly executed constitution, but it does have, it has one. And you know, did you see how quickly that travel ban was overturned in the courts? I mean, that was really impressive, and it was done, you know, obviously because of the hard work of a lot of lawyers who were working, you know, around the clock and for free. But it was done on a constitutional basis, and you can actually point to this document that will tell you, you know, basically what the things that you can't get away with.
And, yeah.
You know, so there he is, and he, you know, he's a, it's obvious how dangerous and scary he is because he keeps telling us. But, you know, he's there's a very large wall and very diverse wall of resistance that he's going to meet, and I hope it ruins his life. Because I think he got the job thinking that I mean, he, you know, his ignorance about what being president actually meant was clear during the campaign, and I think that he thought it meant, I think his sort of like 5-year-old view of a democratic system is that if you win, you get to be a dictator for 4 years. But, you know, that's not the case. And, I mean, I'm still, you know, it's still, very frightening, but to be perfectly honest with you, I'm more upset about Brexit than I am about Trump. I mean, Trump is a more, you know, dramatic, his election was a more dramatic event, I guess. And he obviously is, you know, individually as appalling a character as you could imagine. But, you know, first of all, unless he abolishes elections, there will be another one and another presidential election.
Yeah.
And there'll be a midterm election in 2 years where there's at least the possibility that the Republicans will lose their majority, and then he basically won't be able to do anything.
Yeah.
So that's something. But, you know, like even if he lasts 4 years, or even if he lasts 8 years somehow, excuse me, that's 8 years or 4 years of, you know, potential calamity at all moments.
Yeah.
But Brexit is going to, the results of Brexit are gonna drag down a generation, or more. You know, potentially. I mean, look, maybe all this fantasy talk that its supporters or, you know, apologists are prattling on about for the last 6 months. Maybe it'll all come true. There's no evidence to suggest that it will, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it won't. But you know, if it does, like if somehow it improves, I mean, I don't see how it could possibly improve the cultural life of Britain. I mean, it's a that's a joke. But you know, it, if it does improve the economy, then great. You know, I'll be as happy as anyone else. But it won't, and that's it's just such a. I just see it as a theft of the future of young people by old people, essentially.
Yeah,
and by liars and crooks and of course Trump is both of those things, but he's not going to be with us that long, so that's my view on it. And
yeah,
you know, I don't. Sorry if that.
I mean, enjoyed that. That's great. Whatever.
But as far as not being able to, you know, feeling like you can't talk about it, I mean, you know, of course. You know, I mean, it's not so great to be in an echo chamber, but we are in a bit of an echo chamber here in New York. I mean, this, you know, I haven't met a Trump supporter. I've met some people who sort of defend him a bit, but I don't believe that I know anyone who voted for him. And I was in Texas last week, or actually just a couple of days ago, after I got back from Australia. And you know, the pattern in this country is the same as it is. You know, in Texas as it is in New York, and it's the same here as it is in the UK, which is that in cities, Trump is loathed. And the first thing that people did when they met us in this concert in Texas the other day was to welcome us and say, look, just so you know, just in case you're in any doubt, we're on the same side as presumably you are. I mean, there's a sort of unspoken assumption among artists anyway, but you know, Dallas voted for Hillary Clinton, Houston voted for Hillary Clinton, San Antonio, Austin, all the cities in America basically voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
The suburbs and the rural areas went the other way, and it's, you know, just like it is in the UK. And it's weird to have this sort of, I mean, it was weird actually being on the plane and like watching the route of the flight tracker going across the deep South and thinking, wow, if I parachuted out of this plane right now in another country, but if I, at the destination in a city, then I'll be in the same country that I left. It's scary to think about that. They're just the intensity of the division and what it means for the future.
What are some of the favorite projects that you're involved in at the moment?
I'm in a band that's led by Gonzalo Rubalcaba, and we are playing the music of Charlie Hayden, and we did a record that came out probably, I don't know, a year ago or something, called Charlie. It's three of my favorite musicians. Actually, it's probably the three people that if I had to put a band together and could call anyone I wanted, it's them.
Oh, wow.
So it's Gonzalo on piano and Matt Brewer on bass and Marcus Gilmore on drums. Some of the time, and some of the time it's Jeff Ballard on drums. So, you know, so that's a drag. So we're touring a bit.
We
toured for a couple of weeks last November, and we just did a gig in Texas, and when I come to London next week, it'll be just to sort of spend a few days with the parents before I start a little tour, in Europe with Gonzalo.
Oh, amazing.
And there's talk of a new record of original music, perhaps this year or later this year with him, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
I put out a record last year on his label, called Perfectly Out of Place. And he's on that, Gonzalo, that is.
Oh, cool.
along with Matt Penn and Mike Moreno, Jeff Ballard, and there's a string quartet, and my wife Jo Laurie is on a couple of tracks, and you know, so doing a record for a label that actually has a supportive budget is an amazing blessing, but has a slight curse to it, which is that if you hire all the musicians that you really want, then you're never going to be able to tour with the same band that's on the record.
So, right, yeah.
So when it comes to touring, I'm having to find some other options, but I will be touring later this year, playing the music essentially from that record with a different band, which will be Shy Maestro on piano and Matt Brewer and Henry Cole on drums.
Oh, wow.
Cool. So that'll be fun. I think we'll be playing in London for a night or two.
We're definitely going to keep an eye out for that. That'll be
It'll be in September sometime. What other projects? Well, I have a really busy year this year doing some doing a handful of teaching residencies, which is going to take a bit of my time. I've got one in Helsinki after this tour, and then I have one in Australia. I'm going back to Australia in May.
Oh, well, that sounds cool. How long do you do those residencies for?
Well, they're usually about a week each.
Right.
But they feel longer because they're like pretty intense teaching all day every day. And then I'm doing the Siena Jazz Workshop in July, which is great because that's a great little summer school. And then I'm doing a few guest projects this year. I'm playing with some French musicians in April in France, and I'm going to tour with. I'm going to do my own tour in Japan for the first time.
Oh, beautiful! That sounds great.
Yeah, that's something I've been wanting to do for a long time. And I'm working on a project, for a new recording project. I'm working on putting it together, I should say.
Right.
It'll happen at the end of the year or beginning of next year. And I can tell you what the plan is, but I'm not going to mention any names until they're confirmed. But the plan is to make a record with five pianists, and to do one duet piece and one quartet piece with each one of them.
Oh, that's a great idea. I love it.
Yeah. So and they're going to be, one of them will be Gonzalo Rubalcaba.
Yeah.
And the other four will be very heavy.
Sweet.
I can't tell you exactly who they are yet because I haven't actually confirmed anything, but I'm it's looking good.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Definitely.
Yes, I'm excited about that. And Jo, my wife, has a project coming out that we worked on together. It's all her original songs, or mostly, and we sort of produced it together and wrote the arrangements together. She did a Pledge Music campaign that was very successful, so her record, The Bathtub and the Sea, will be coming out later this year. It's more, she has a jazz background, but she's kind of been more in the sort of crossover and pop world lately. She was Sting's sole backing singer for 7 years. And so she's sort of between two worlds, but I'm really excited about that record. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, that sounds that's really interesting.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit going on this year.
yeah, definitely. There's a lot to keep you amused.
And then between it all, I'm just at home with the cats.
I think both of our cats have managed to meow their way into this episode tonight.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's definitely a first. Yours did a cracker about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, really? Oh, cool. I've actually got two. They were born in the backyard.
Oh, bless them.
To a feral mother, and we took them in, and they're awesome. They're about 6 months old now.
Oh, amazing. They're still quite young.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on.
Not at all, man.
Oh, it was great to sit and chat and get political and all that. Yeah, it's awesome.
Nobody needs to know my views, but I also think these days it's you have to address it almost. Maybe you don't have to, but I mean, I suppose I would be very sympathetic to the idea that actually you have to ignore it too.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I don't know, when if the subject doesn't come up, it's always kind of on my mind. Oh, what is that? Where does this person stand on this, that, or the other?
Yeah, it's quite scary if you're friends with that person and you're kind of scared to bring it up. Brexit, where you're like, I don't really want to know what they think.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it shouldn't be like that.
Because, yeah.
And I also don't see anybody necessarily, like, who voted one way or the other to be, even an opponent, never mind the enemy, because I feel like, you know, there are people can make sincere decisions and I can just sincerely disagree with them.
Yeah.
But anyway, whatever. Cool. Do you want to know when those gigs are going to be in London?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Let's see if I can find that. Oh, okay. 4th and 5th of September.
Amazing. I'll definitely come along to one of those and we can, get you a beer as a token of my eternal gratitude.
Please. Oh, yeah, no, that's true. At the pizza, you have to pay for them.
Well, there you go. That's all the more reason.
Cool.
Amazing.
All right, man. Well, thanks, nice Will. To talk to you.
Yeah, that was amazing. And, thanks for making the time for us.
Anytime.
Beautiful. All right, speak to you soon. Cheers.
See you later.
Bye. I've just found on the London Jazz News podcast with Freddie Gavita. Our next album preview is going to be Freddie's new album, which is coming out.
Well, it's April now, so we can do another one.
Yeah, perfect. I think his album comes out on the 29th of April. But the launch gig is before that. Wednesday the 19th of April, upstairs at Ronnie's. Freddie specifically asked for his album launch preview show to come out on the 21st of April.
Okay.
Which is a Monday, which is perfect for us.
Great.
Although London Jazz have already made the exact podcast that we were going to make, where they play some music and then they talk to Freddie, but we should go ahead and make ours anyway.
Do you think they'll mind if we do that as well?
We could just play theirs, couldn't we? I don't think Freddie will mind.
Why don't we listen to what they say and ask different questions?
Oh, I like it. Let's do the alternative reality podcast in which we're not allowed to ask anything that they asked.
Anything?
Yeah, no questions.
That's going to be hard.
That'll be amazing. So next week's show is Lauren Kinsella.
Oh, okay.
The very first of the singers in our lives.
Is it?
I think so.
Great. That'll be good then.
Yes. So next Friday...
Right.
A special Good Friday bank holiday show is what Lauren's will be.
Okay.
And then interviewing Jim Hart a couple of days later. So, it'll be cool to have Jim on the show. I guess technically he's an international artist now because he lives in Europe and we live in this tiny island.
Oh, where does
Britain.
He live?
I think he lives in France in the mountains.
Oh, does he?
Yes. With his wife, I think, and probably making some... incorrect and immature guesses.
Some fake news.
Yeah, absolutely. But I know he comes back, obviously he commutes a lot, so you wouldn't really know, I guess, unless you asked him about it. But yeah, he definitely he counts as one of our... He can be the third. It's like the NFL when they come to Wembley, they call it the International Series. That's where we're going.
Right, great.
Might have to do Fred subtitles, you know, for his big fan base there.
I'll try and translate it.
Oh, that'd be great if you could just... We could just turn down the audio and you could speak over it in French.
Yeah.
You know, like on the news when they do an overdubbed interview.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Let's make a real mess of a show that nobody can hear.
We're not a multimedia series, though, people, we won't be able to have subtitles.
No, I know, that's the beauty of it, because it would be a lot of effort.
To put subtitles on a podcast?
On an audio podcast. I think that idea, mixed with our minute silence, we're onto some pretty weird stuff. This is ideal.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Well, from me, from Dan, and from Will, until Friday.
How are you so nasal?
I don't know. I feel like I can sort of just be nasal.
Till Friday.
I like it.
Yeah, dear.
Maybe I'll make Jack come on to do. Jack Davies can do a good impression of me.
Oh, okay, great. Maybe he'll replace Ruben's segment.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Maybe. Oh, yes, Dan, yes. Claire, can you do a good impression of me? Sometimes.
Let's hear it, Claire. Come a bit closer.
Come and talk to Dan. Come on, just say good morning to him. Hang on. Claire's making me...
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Claire. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Cheers. Can I hear your Rob impression?
I can't do it under pressure. Morning, guys. How's Spain?
It's great, thanks.
Oh, I think you like it.